Hello again, this is Seldom Said. My name is Robert. This is the place where conversation matters. It is not often that we have a repeat guest, but every now and again we have someone of special interest who certainly makes an additional program worthwhile. Our guest today is Mr. Frank Amoroso. Mr. Amoroso is a gentleman that we spoke of earlier in a program talking about the life of Otto Kahn. This time we'll be dealing with his new project, and that is the assassination of the Archduke Franz Ferdinand in 1914. How are you, Frank?
I'm very well, Robert, and thank you for having me.
It is my pleasure, I can assure you. I wonder if we could begin with a discussion of your process. You mentioned that you deal in fictional history. Can you give us a précis of that, a definition?
Well, I think I have to make a correction there and switch the words around, not fictional history, because that is propaganda. But what I write is historical fiction, which is taking history, looking at the characters involved, the personages involved that create the events that we learn as history, and putting them into a narrative form, into a novel form that will entertain, educate, and intrigue the reader. So by capturing the essence of the major movers and shakers in any particular event or historical era, it's very useful to tell the story through their lives, their motivations, their choices, their good points and bad points in the context of their humanity.
Interesting. You mentioned the word propaganda. There's a marvelous quote attributed to Woody Guthrie whereby he says that a lullaby is propaganda for a baby. Everything is propaganda, in his opinion. How do you avoid giving rise to an essence of opinion in your work whereby a point of view is promulgated and projected rather than the historical fiction or the fictional history that you're trying to deal with?
I don't think it's possible to, to avoid a point of view. The balance is to not proselytize, but to present the story through your sensitivities and sensibilities and values that you hope will tell the story in the way it should be told. If you corrupt the story by having an agenda, then it defeats the purpose of educating and entertaining the reader, because the reader will quickly understand that you are trying to persuade and trying to contort the facts to fit your particular point of view, and I don't think that is something that I would be interested in reading.
Do you feel that the type of work, then, that you do would be applicable to a high school or collegial history textbook?
I think very definitely, because what I'm trying to capture are the personalities of the major players. So what drove me to write Behind Every Great Fortune was the very dynamic, influential personality of Otto Hermann Kahn, and using him as sort of a vehicle to tell the story and bring out the foibles, for example, of Tsar Nicholas II, or to bring out the extreme personality flaws of Rasputin, enables the reader to get into the dynamics of the personalities. And I think when you traditionally history has been taught in a relatively dry manner, with dates and facts and milestones that really don't have any life to them, And by telling the story through the people and through their motivations, I think it would be a perfect vehicle for high school students and perhaps even younger to appreciate that so many things have not changed, that people's motivations and people's inherent desires and flaws are acted out in these otherwise dry historical events. So I think it's an attempt as a creative writer to breathe life into history.
That certainly is something very well needed. What is it in a character, his emotion, his presentation, that draws you as an author, as an investigator, Frank?
I believe that there are people who have personalities that drive events. So, for example, Otto Kahn was such a person. Rasputin was such a person. Churchill was such a person. I think people with strong emotions and strong values that seek to lead and impress their thoughts and values on their surroundings is what makes it exciting. So when I'm looking to for a subject to write about, I will be looking for the big dominant personalities and how they interact with others around them and how they influence events and ultimately determine world history.
Do you subscribe to a great man theory of history? The historian Carlyle always argued that a great man was a match, the events with a tinder. Do you believe that there are such people who instigate, promulgate change, and they're necessary?
Most definitely. I think things don't happen by inertia, by just, well, we're in motion, we'll continue in motion. I think things happen because people want them to happen. Now, I also believe in the law of unintended consequences, that people may drive toward a certain objective, but it may not turn out the way they expected it because of other events or other people pushing and pulling in different directions. But I definitely subscribe to the view that the great man or the ambitious, the proud, the strong, domineering type person is the person that is going to drive events. And you can see it in military history, whether it's George Patton or Genghis Khan. You can see it in political history, whether it's Julius Caesar or Winston Churchill or Abraham Lincoln, for that matter.
Your definition of greatness, and as a follow-up, have you encountered it or seen it in your lifetime?
Well, I can say that I have met very few great people in the profession that I spent most of my career as a lawyer. There were a number of towering lawyers, but they were not on the national or public scene. It's in terms of public life throughout, it's kind of difficult, and this may sound a little controversial, but I think we are seeing such a person in Vladimir Putin. And I don't necessarily ascribe positive to greatness, but I think in terms of a person who is succeeding somewhat in imposing his will on the world, he stands out. And of course, we've seen negative great people or people with who created negative results throughout history, whether it was, you know, Hitler or Mussolini or other people, but I think by certain metrics you have to recognize that people of that nature were able to motivate and incite and create great change. And I think that's something that the world has been subject to since time immemorial.
It's an interesting point. One is reminded that in the 30s, Adolf Hitler was on the cover of Time as Man of the Year, which in retrospect sounds inane, but at the time and place, it carried weight. Would you take the position, Frank, that greatness can be evil, and it can be successful at being evil?
Oh, most definitely. I think I alluded to it earlier that greatness does not necessarily result in positive results. So
indeed,
Hitler
yes.
would be the perfect example. I mean, he was a great leader. I mean, anyone who can motivate a nation or numerous nations, his whole alliance, to perform the tasks that he was able to get them to perform, albeit, you know, immensely evil and inherently and obviously evil, he has to be recognized, however, as a great leader. And I think that is a lesson that we need to be careful about, that just because someone is a great motivator, a great inciter, doesn't mean that they are leading us in a direction that we should go. And I think it requires courage of people around great people to put the brakes on them. And I think that's one of the amazing things about the United States. In looking at history, and I'm going to be giving a presentation this weekend about the assassination of the Archduke Ferdinand, and looking at the history of the latter part of the 19th century and early part of the 20th century, I was just amazed at how many assassinations there were, that there are so many leaders, the King of Italy, the President of the United States, Tsar Alexander in Russia, the Prime Minister of Spain, and numerous other leaders of state were assassinated. Well, in the United States, that is not common. Unfortunately, it has happened too many times. But in the United States, we transfer power from one administration to another peacefully. And that is one of the things that sets us apart and makes us unique and exceptional.
Do you feel that our lives and our world has become overtly violent, and that the assassin, who was initially a religious prospect during the Crusades, is more prevalent in our lives, the person who changes the world with the stroke of a pen, a sword, or a gun? That we live in more violent, more confrontational times than you have experienced in your study of history?
I think quite the opposite. It seems like from the period that I just described, the late 1800s and early 1900s, that assassination was the way to change administrations. However, I was thinking about what we have today and what we are looking at, and although in the 60s we had numerous assassinations, tragic indeed, we have not had that sort of violence in the world. Now, I certainly believe that the world is as violent, if not more violent, than at any time in history. But we haven't seen the assassinations of leaders as prevalent as it was 100 years ago.
We're within 30 seconds of our first break. Perhaps you would contemplate a response to the following, Frank. The idea that to deal with greatness, to deal with greatness that is both positive and negative, one has to exude greatness themselves, whether the ordinary man can be a subject of a future book. This is Seldom Said. My name is Robert.
Suddenly Solo on WCWP takes a look at life for single men over 50. Join Hal Spielman and Mark Silbert Wednesday mornings at 10 a.m. for discussion on dating, housekeeping, finances, and much more. Suddenly Solo, Wednesday mornings at 10 a.m. only on 88.1 FM and WCWP.org.
Don't bark up the wrong tree. Go to the Children's Story Hour at the Steinberg Museum of Art at Hillwood, located on the LIU Post Campus. Enjoy Dorothea Warren Fox's story, Miss Twigley's Tree, on Monday, July 7th from 3 to 4 p.m. To RSVP, call 516-299-4073 or contact liu.edu/museum for more information. The community calendar is a public service from your friends at 88.1 FM and WCWP.org.
If all you really need to know is learned in kindergarten, then here's your chance to be 5 years old again. On Thursday, July 8th, at 10 a.m. in the Plainview Old Bethpage Public Library, Sharper Training Solutions presents Computer Kindergarten for Grown-Ups. The workshop is first-time user-friendly and costs $5 per person. For more info, call 516-938-0077 or visit poblib.org. The community calendar is a public service from your friends at 88.1 FM and WCWP.org.
Hey, we'll get you in the proper mood on The Rock Show. Weeknights from 7 to 9 on WCWP. Free experience the days of freeform radio with theme shows, rare recordings, and classic cuts you won't hear anywhere else.
Rock me all night long.
The Rock Show. It's definitely eclectic. Monday through Friday at 7 p.m. only on 88.1 FM and WCWP.org.
Welcome back. My name is Robert. This is Seldom Said. Our guest today is Mr. Frank Amoroso. Frank, we had ended the first segment with the question posited, do you feel greatness is in everyone? I'm thinking of Gavrilo Princip sitting at the side of the road and along comes the Archduke in his carriage. Is everyone capable of great and wondrous things, both on the positive and negative side?
I don't think so, because particularly with regard to Gavrilo Princip, it was almost a matter of serendipity that he was in the place of in time and space with the intent to assassinate, that he was able to perform the assassination. I think, unfortunately, the average person or the common person does not benefit or have the benefit of the confluence of circumstances that allows him or her to perform some great or some great evil, some great act or some great evil. So I think the answer is that that we all have tremendous value and worth, but we don't always get the opportunity. And I think what distinguishes the great leaders is that very often they are the ones that force the opportunities that Julius Caesar crossed the Rubicon. If he had been a little more cautious and prudent, he wouldn't have crossed the Rubicon and declared himself the leader of Rome. So, and not everybody has that within them. So I think that's a little bit of a long, rambling answer to your question. But just by way of background, Princip was the person who pulled the trigger and assassinated the Archduke Ferdinand and his wife, Sophie, the Duchess of Hohenberg. But what happened was during the motorcade, they were touring Sarajevo, a grenade was thrown at the motorcade and didn't hit its mark and blew up the car behind the Archduke. Well, the motorcade then sped off and went to town hall, and on their way back to the garrison, they decided to visit the hospital to see the people that were injured. And when they turned onto a side road toward the hospital, the motorcade stopped, and that's where Princhep was having lunch. And he walked out of the delicatessen, pulled out his revolver, and shot the Archduke and his wife while the car was not moving. So it was almost serendipitous the way that happened. And I know people have asked the question, well, wouldn't the war have occurred anyway? Wouldn't World War I have ignited anyway? That's a difficult question to answer, because cause and effect creates a lot of uncertainty. So if that cause of the assassination had not occurred when it did, who knows what the effect might have been. At that time, the Russian military was frantically scrambling to modernize. And one of the reasons that Kaiser Wilhelm was anxious to take on the Russians at that time was because he was fully modernized and they were not. Had the assassination not taken place and had some other event a year later perhaps precipitated a war, maybe the Kaiser would not have wanted to take on the Russians, because they would have been that much more advanced in their preparation. So change of one event can offset and change future events in unimagined ways.
The coincidence of events in this assassination are indeed incredible. Looking at some of the studies of the era, Frank, particularly a great book, Guns of August, by Barbara Tuchman, can you see parallel events in the world today? You mentioned, for instance, President Putin's analogies to greatness. Can you see things like this occurring, dominoes falling one into the other, and suddenly it's totally out of hand?
Very definitely. I was extremely apprehensive about 6 or 8 weeks ago, when the Ukrainian crisis was really bubbling up and becoming a serious world concern, that the Russians were seeking to destabilize Ukraine and seeking to take over Ukraine. And I read that Secretary of State Kerry was going to Kiev to meet with the leaders of Ukraine. And I just had this horrible thought that, well, what would happen if the American Secretary of State were assassinated in Kiev? And that would be akin to what happened in Sarajevo in 1914, when Archduke Ferdinand was assassinated. You had a foreign leader in a country assassinated, and that forced everybody to live up to their alliances. And so if the United States had declared war or made aggressive action against the people that assassinated one of our officials, who knows where the dominoes would start to fall. And that's an example of how dangerous the times we live in are, because there are so many tinderboxes, whether it's in the Middle East or in Ukraine or in Southeast Asia. There are just so many areas that could lead to a reaction and an overreaction, and before you know it, you're engaged in world war.
Do you feel then, Frank, that one of the greatest attributes of a leader who is considered great historically today is patience?
I think it's something that it's an attribute that I would want in my leadership. You certainly don't want people with quick trigger fingers when nuclear weapons are involved. It's interesting in our current world, when you look at the conflicts throughout the world, most of them, in my estimation, are proxy conflicts. So even though we are engaged in military action in the Middle East, it's really a proxy for Iran and Russia. In the controversies that we have in Afghanistan and in Southeast Asia, there are Chinese and Russian forces in Korea, certainly the Chinese, and in Afghanistan, the Russians are proxy. The Taliban and the Mujahideen are really proxies for those other major powers.
You mentioned Mujahideen, and you mentioned parts of the world where there's danger. Did you find any inherent religiosity in the conflict that followed the assassination of Franz and Sophie?
It's sub rosa, because I think it's not politically correct to talk about the conflict that has existed for millennia between Western Europe, and by that I'm referring to Christian Western Europe, and Muslim Middle East. One of the things that ignited or motivated the conflict that led to World War II was the demise of the Ottoman Empire. For 600 years, there was one ruling sultanate in the Ottoman Empire, and they were on the way of demise, and that created a vacuum, and the Balkan states were attempting to fill that vacuum in a nationalistic way, and that was antithetical to what the Russians, the Austrians, and the Germans had in mind for that area of the world. So there has been a continual ebb and flow between the Western European Christians and the Ottoman Turks, Muslim forces. And I think, as I said, it's not politically correct to say that, but that's my understanding and reading of history.
We seem to have a love affair in this country with Jeffersonian democracy, and we seem to think it's applicable everywhere, every time, any place. The Archduke was a pragmatic man, but he was also an autocrat. Is there, in your research, in your writing, the feeling that autocracy at times can be necessary?
I think autocracy can be almost essential in cultures that have been brought up in that mode of governance. So, for example, in Russia, Russia has been ruled for centuries and centuries by autocrats, and the cultural institutions, the grassroots type democratic institutions that exist in, for example, the United States, don't exist there. So, in order for there to be a maturation of the society where it would accept elected officials in a progressive fashion, that will have to take time. And I think when we try to impose Jeffersonian democracy in areas that have been ruled by autocrats for centuries, if not forever, we make a serious mistake, because the grassroots institutions are not there. They don't have the local school boards and the local sheriff elected and the local county commissioners and local municipal officials that that are answerable and expect to answer to the populace.
So you would take the position that not everyone at any given time and place in their history is ready to be free. It's in a caustic fashion that I just posited it, but there seems to be a relevance and truth in that.
Well, I think so, and I think when you consider what Benjamin Franklin said when he was asked about, you know, the type of government that, that they created in Philadelphia for the United States, he said, well, we've given you a republic if you can keep it. And I would say that that applies across the board, that there's no perfect form of government for every society, and that the society has to be prepared to implement and nurture and respect the type of government that's there. And if the society is not in the position to do that, you can impose the most perfect form of government on it, and it will fail because the society is not ready for it.
The world seems to have had so many marble men in its history, people who have succeeded or failed on a great level, and we remember them with an aura. I'm drawn to the fact that, and you had mentioned this too in your presentation of Hika Castle, that Franz and Sophie were lovers, they were people, they were drawn to each other. They were royalty, but also something very ordinary and special, one to the other. Can you describe them as a couple?
They were a truly exceptional, loving couple, and particularly in the context of the times that they lived in. They had meals regularly, dinner and breakfast with their children. They spent time with their children. They did not have nannies and send them off to boarding school. From all accounts and the letters and the accounts, firsthand accounts of people who knew the family, they were an exceptionally well-bonded family unit, and they cared for each other and they looked out for each other, much like you know, you would hope that a mother and a father and children would exist and love each other. So they were exceptional in the times, but what made it historically significant was the fact that under the laws of the Austro-Hungarian Empire at that time, she was not deemed sufficiently royal for him to marry, and he petitioned the emperor, and the emperor refused to allow him to get married. Ultimately, Franz threatened to commit suicide, and the Pope intervened and asked the emperor to relent. The emperor relented and said, well, okay, I will let you get married, but it has to be a morganatic marriage, which meant that Franz had to give up all of his rights of succession for his offspring that he hoped to have. He had to give up various titles and revenues, and his wife, his beloved, was never to be treated as an empress or as royalty. She was always to be considered a second-class citizen, and she was routinely humiliated in the Viennese court because anything that would lead anyone to conclude that she was of equal status with her husband was prevented. So she wasn't allowed to sit with him at the opera. She wasn't allowed to sit next to him at a state dinner. She wasn't allowed to be next to him at a receiving line. She had to be introduced last when they introduced all the royalty at a particular state function. She wasn't allowed to even have the imperial seal on her carriage, all of which would have been indicative that she was of equal status, and the law routinely and firmly said that she was not royal, and therefore she would not be recognized as such. So it was a very different time, but also a extremely compelling personal story of the trials and the humiliations that they lived with, and the way they nurtured their family and had wonderfully well-rounded children.
Indeed, it's not every courtship that needs the intercession of an emperor and a pope. I'm wondering, in your pursuit of history and your pursuit of writing history with a certain fictional tone, a liberal tone, whether you can read into the possibilities of what might have happened if both had lived, what type of emperor this man might have become.
I think it would have been extremely exciting and would definitely have changed the course of history. One of the things that Franz did in preparation for his eventual succession to the throne was he took a world tour, and he ended up visiting the United States and was exceptionally impressed with the federal system that we have. And he had written about the possibility of reshuffling the Austro-Hungarian Empire to reflect the federal system that the United States had. And also, he was very advanced in his thinking about the Balkans. Tragically, he was assassinated by a Serbian nationalist radical, but his plan for the Balkans was to unite them in a federal way that they would have...
Frank, if I may, I must apologize. We're about to enter into our second break. Please to hold that thought. It's fascinating. My name is Robert. This is Seldom Said.
Dear WCWP, I'm in big trouble because I just can't find any good music on my radio. Please, I need your help. Can you play something slow and bluesy?
I miss the arms that used to hold me.
Cool. How about some rock and roll?
I say the joint was rocking.
Some new stuff?
I want a piece of your heart.
Nice, but do you have anything different? Well, thank you, WCWP. That's great music.
The afternoon music mix is music just for you. Noon till 6 on 88.1 FM and WCWP.org.
Independence has partnered with the St. Francis Hospital Community Outreach Program for a series of free health screenings for patients ages 18 and over. Screenings include a brief cardiac history, blood pressure, cholesterol, and diabetes testing, with patient education and referrals as needed. The next screening will be held on Thursday, July 10th, from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the Manhasset Valley Residence. For more information, please call 311 or 869-6311.
If you can't see the forest for the trees, then you'll be going to the Steinberg Museum of Art at Hillwood on the LIU Post campus. The exhibit, Trees, features artists Nancy Kirk, John Day, and others from June 2nd until July 11th. For more info, call 516-299-4073 or contact liu.edu/museum. The community calendar is a public service from your friends at 88.1 FM and WCWP.org.
Saturdays on WCWP. Great music in the mix starting at 7 a.m. Catch the political news of the week on Ring of Fire at 9. Snap Judgment brings you storytelling with a beat at 11. The Rock Show Saturday keeps you rocking from noon to 7. Your weekend playlist is in the mix starting at 7. And keep the party going with Total Access Late Night at 11. Every Saturday on 88.1 FM and WCWP.org.
Hello again. My name is Robert. This is Seldom Said. Our guest today is Mr. Frank Amoroso. Frank, if you would continue with that fascinating discussion of what might have happened if the Archduke had lived and his attitude toward federalizing the empire.
Sure. In 1914, the Austro-Hungarian Empire was also called the dual monarchy, and basically it was the monarchy of Austria and the monarchy of Hungary. And Franz Ferdinand saw that this was a bit outmoded, and he wanted to enhance the stature of the Slavic peoples in the Balkans. He would have faced opposition from the Austrians and the Magyars in Hungary, but this was a priority, and had he succeeded, it would have diffused a lot of the animosity that existed in that tinder keg of the Balkans. In addition, he wanted to reach out and establish an alliance with the Russians that had historically existed and was abandoned after the Franco-Prussian War in 1870. So he would have, if he had succeeded, he would have changed the balance of power and the way people viewed themselves in a positive way. In addition, in contrast to the Emperor Franz Joseph, who at that time was in his 80s and had been on the throne for over 65 years, he was very rigid and doctrinaire and an adherent obsessively toward the status quo. And he didn't even ride in an elevator because it was too modern. He only rode in a motor car once in his life. So he was really symptomatic of the stagnation and decadence of the monarchies, particularly in Austria-Hungary. And Franz was a more modern person. He had traveled the world. He had seen and embraced modern inventions, the Industrial Revolution, and he understood that that was changing the world. And because the world view of the leadership in Austria-Hungary, in the Ottoman Empire, and to some degree in Germany, we ended up in this tragic war that had 20 million casualties. Of course, I'm referring to World War One, and I go through a lot of these dynamics in my book, Behind Every Great Fortune, which covers the turbulent second decade of the 20th century.
What do you feel might have been the relationship, reading into the future, between Franz Ferdinand as an emperor and the Kaiser?
I think he would have been a strong enough personality to stand up to the Kaiser. Whereas Franz Joseph was a weak old man who was very rigid in his ways, and he was basically cowed by the Kaiser and did whatever the Kaiser wanted him to do. Franz had a more of an equal relationship with the Kaiser. Actually, about a month before the assassination, Franz and Wilhelm met in Austria, and I think had as people of the same age, of the same era, I think they had a better relationship and understanding, and would have worked as equals, as opposed to the Kaiser just dominating the emperor.
Do you feel, Frank, that at times there is a danger in saying, well, it works, let's keep it? That change is necessary? At times, as inane as it may sound, change for the sake of change.
That's an interesting question. I think, I guess I would refer to Gracie Slick and her song, which said, everything changes, nothing remains the same. And as each moment in time passes, what existed that moment in the past no longer exists in the next moment. So I think change is inevitable, and as people, we need to be able to appreciate to change, not fight it. I think we need to not mean that, well, nothing is transcendent. There are values that exist despite change, but that we have to acknowledge and deal with change. If you don't acknowledge and deal with it, then you are a reactionary who is doomed to failure, because change is happening no matter whether you want it or not.
It's marvelous, the curiosity in regard to the events that you've pursued. An archduke, an assassination, and Gracie Slick all in one sentence, and that's that's rather incredible. I am curious, the description of the assassination itself, Frank, an open carriage being led through a very difficult area, a place of danger, a place where forecasts of problems had occurred. Was it reckless bravado or simply normal protocol that that's the way these two individuals decided to visit Sarajevo?
Well, it's a very imponderable question, and I think that you need to add to the mix of danger the fact that it was Saint Vitus Day in Serbia, which is celebrated as the day that they achieve victory over a foreign conqueror. And here you have on that very day a foreign conqueror in the person of the Archduke coming in and parading through the streets. It would be akin to George III strolling into Washington on the 4th of July. It just was not a recipe for a good reception. In all of my reading, I find some hints and innuendos that he may have been set up, that there were forces in the Viennese court and in the military that feared some of his ideas, and perhaps were not too upset when he was placed in a dangerous condition. Now, all that having been said, there's another dynamic that was at play, and I alluded to it earlier in the humiliations that his wife suffered in the court. As a traveling military dignitary, the officials in Bosnia, where Sarajevo is, accorded her the highest deference. And she was allowed to ride in the same car with him. She was allowed to appear at dinners with him. She was allowed to be at all the official functions at his side in the receiving line. So I think that perhaps influenced them, Franz and Sophie, that this was a benign environment. They had indeed traveled into the city on one or two occasions before this motorcade that led to the assassination, and they had been very comfortable in walking through the streets and the market. And there's even an account that Princip was came upon them while they were shopping, and he thought about performing the assassination at that point, but he was afraid of hitting Sophie. It's kind of ironic that when the time came that he ended up firing two shots and killing Sophie and killing Franz, recklessly.
It is interesting that the last words spoken into a chief executive's ear before he falls asleep are the whispers of his wife. What type of person was Sophia? She seemed recessive in the sense that she tolerated all of these indignities, but there also seems to be an inherent strength in the woman.
She was an exceptional person. She was highly educated, very cosmopolitan. She spoke four languages. she was extremely vivacious and a beauty. She, I think, was Franz's the great woman behind the great man. She was just a incredibly supportive person. The problem that she had was that her family was not financially independently wealthy, and also that they were not recognized as nobility, even though her family had been nobility since the 1500s in Bohemia, which later became Czechoslovakia. They were an elite family, but they were not considered elite by the Habsburgs because they were not Habsburgs. So she was just a fascinating figure, strong, and as you alluded to, able to handle the slights and insults that were thrown her way. She just raised her family and defended her family and supported her husband in every way possible.
On one side, we have this potential greatness, a potential emperor and his wife. On the other, we have this nondescript individual who historians have given a footnote and nothing more. What type of person was Gavrilo Princip? He was not a madman, and yet he did an outrageous thing. What is your take on the man himself?
It's interesting. One man's nationalist patriot is another man's terrorist. So, curiously, Gavrilo Princip is considered a national hero in Serbia. Of course, to the eyes of modern Western civilization, he's considered a dastardly terrorist who assassinated Archduke Ferdinand. He was extremely young. After the assassination, he was arrested and tried and convicted, and at that time the Bosnian Constitution said that you could not execute someone who was under the age of 20. So he escaped the death sentence because he was under 20. He was a college student. He was an extreme nationalist, had tremendous fervor for the Serbian cause, and he was recruited by a cabal of Serbian military officers known as the Black Hand. And they recruited Gavrilo Princip and another seven other students to commit this assassination because they considered the annexation of Bosnia as contrary to the annexation of Bosnia by Austria-Hungary in 1908 as contrary to the interests of Serbia, which wanted to create what they called the Greater Serbia and unite all of the Balkan states under Serbian rule. So he was a fervent, dedicated patriot in his mind who misguidedly assassinated the future emperor and led to World War I.
We've discussed it earlier in the program, but perhaps expanding upon the idea, it would seem that passion is easy for those in power to manipulate. Is it just as easy to sublimate, and if so, how?
I'm not sure where you're going with that question. It seems to me that the powers that be, regardless of the type of government, has the ability to incite the populace or to sedate the populace. And I think we see it certainly in modern times with the way the press is willfully or unwittingly used as a tool to fire our passions before we engage in military action. There are a series of articles and programs which tend to demonize our future enemy. All you have to do is look at what went on with the Japanese internment in the 40s, where they imprisoned Japanese Americans and created this demon that eventually became our enemy in World War II. Now they're our great friends. Same thing has happened repeatedly throughout history, and it doesn't only happen in our country. I think that the powers that be tend to want to manipulate public opinion either for or against. I mean, we can look at a territorial incursion by a foreign power and say, well, that's no big deal, or we can look at it and say, oh my goodness, these people are demons and we need to stop them. This is the red line in the sand, so to speak. So it's unfortunate that that we are subject to that sort of manipulation, but I think that's a reality.
It is incredible that most events in history have occurred because passions were not warranted or banked. Is it possible in the last few minutes we have to develop some sort of premise for dealing with national alienation? We have Maliki asking Shias to rise up and individuals raising their rifles over their head and marching to Baghdad. How does one sublimate passion, or does it simply have to be allowed to shake itself out?
Well, I think there are several ways. I think one of them is by information and the way information is communicated. Another way is to provide for the physical and material needs of people. I laughed at the Occupy movement because they were in Kevlar tents and they were getting catered meals from Wolfgang Puck. And it seemed to me a ludicrous parody of desperate people on the barricades. If you look at Les Miserables, those people were being brutalized and starved and totally dehumanized, and they had no choice but to rise up.
Frank, if I may, I find it intolerable in that it's a discussion that we go on ad infinitum. Well, I guess we're both on the barricade along with the rest of the populace of this world.
Yes.
I thank you for taking part in this discussion. I'm hoping it can be a continuum. Be well, my friend. This is Seldom Said. My name is Robert.